2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
On this episode of First Lady and Friends, we have the audio from an interview I did at the One Utah Summit with Elder Jeffrey R. Holland and his wife, Pat. They were at the summit to receive an award, and they are talking about their experience growing up in Southern Utah. That's where we connect. We both grew up in rural Utah. And the reason I was doing this interview at the summit, I was actually a substitute for my husband. The governor was attending a funeral of one of our service members who had passed away. So I had the opportunity to have this conversation with the Hollands, and it was a lot of fun. So join us for the conversation. Let's get proximate.
We are so excited to have Elder and Sister Holland here today. We share rural roots. We share the love of rural Utah, and we share the love of leadership and those leadership principles. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And this is absolutely my honor to be here with you, Elder and Sister Holland, today.
Thank you, Sister Cox. Thank you. It's our privilege. We're honored. We're surprised. We're stunned. We didn't think anybody knew we were alive, and here you are honoring us. Thank you. And thank you for that wonderful, warm reception.
We know you're alive. and we feel your leadership in the state, so we really appreciate it. Let's talk about this growing up in rural Utah. Talk to us about your parents and your family and how they ended up here.
How much time have you got? My mother is she's a pioneer stock. My great-great-grandfather was the settling citizen of St. George. Robert Gardner led the little camp that settled in St. George. So she goes way back. Her roots are permanent here. My dad was a CCC boy. Does anybody out there know what the CCCs were? Some of you, I see a few hands. My dad was a CCC boy who came during the Depression and was the quartermaster for the parks. He served Zion Canyon and Bryce, and they were stationed in Leeds. Had a little camp in Leeds, if any of you remember that. And he went to pay the telephone bill in St. George as the quartermaster. He was the bill payer, and my mother was the telephone operator, and there it was, love at first sight, right over the telephone wires. So he just stayed. He stayed, and Southern Utah became his home and was permanently my mother's home. Pat's ties are all in Southern Utah, and she was born in Cedar City. I want that known to the Cedar City people. Sometimes the at least at the high school and college level, athletically, there's a little tension between St. George and Cedar, so I want every advantage I can get being in Cedar. It wasn't always a friendly experience here. And so Pat was a Southern Utah girl through and through, still is.
Well, we understand rivalries in rural Utah. We have our North San Pete Manti rivalry.
You do.
And we Just for the record, North San Pete beat Manti at homecoming last week, so we'll just put that out there. So we understand that it runs deep. But tell us more about your courtship. You met here as high school sweethearts. Oops. As well.
You tell the courtship story, honey.
I was, I think, 9 years old, and he might have been 10, He was the poster child for polio, and had a big pitcher, and came to my father's store, and this pitcher hung in the store, and I thought it was the cutest little boy I'd ever seen. But then we didn't start dating until I was 16 or 17, and he was 18, and so we're high school sweethearts.
Again, we have a similar story. Yeah. Spencer and I were in high school and dated while we were high school sweethearts as well, which is really fun to grow up together. Yeah.
Yes. It was a convoluted courtship. We started in high school and then into college, and I went on a mission and just got home 1 month, and she left for New York to study music, and it took us 6 years to get together, mostly by telephone and letters, but we made it after
letters
all of that.
Were wonderful, and that's when I truly fell in love with him. He wrote such beautiful letters. Wonderful.
It is a good way to get to know somebody better. Spencer and I did it for 2 years as well while he was in Mexico. So let's talk about your parents. Obviously, were really influential in your life. Is there? You know, when we talk about successful people, we can usually point to that one caring adult that really took an interest. Or is there somebody in your life that really made a difference for you?
Well, it would have to be my parents and Pat's parents. Both of our fathers were hard workers. Both of them, I think, pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. Pat's dad had a junior college education, came to Dixie, but my dad had only a high school education. One of the ironies, and I say that really as a compliment to this audience and to this state and to America, that in one generation, my dad, who had a seventh grade education, could have a son who presided over a university of 30,000 students or so, I think only in America. And maybe only in Utah could that happen.
Utah way.
Yeah. So they were hard workers. They grew up working hard. That's what they knew. And I'd have to say that our fathers, and for me personally, because I came very close to Pat's dad as we were dating and then married, that they set a magnificent example for us to just. By the sweat of your brow, you can do a lot that people probably had not anticipated, that they had not anticipated, but they did, and told us we could do it, and we did.
Yeah. Amazing. And speaking of that, those values that you instill, what are some other values that you feel like you learned uniquely from rural Utah?
Well, That's an interesting question, Sister Cox. Robert Frost was invited by Jack Kennedy to read poetry. Do you remember, any of you remember that when he was inaugurated? He read a poem called The Gift Outright, was the title of the poem that Frost read. It was about the land. It was about sort of, in that case, rural New England for him, but it'd be rural Utah for us, and he said that before we were the land was ours, and I can't talk about my childhood. I can't talk about our youthful experiences without thinking of it in the context of these colors and this country, and whether it's Cedar Breaks or Kolob or Zion Canyon or Snow Canyon or whatever. We have a luxury here that, you know, the rest of the world would envy. We take it for granted, I guess. Probably grew up taking it for granted. But now that we've been away, wherever we've gone, around the world and back, and don't live in southern Utah anymore, it's still the pull of the land, the colors. I have those paintings in my office and in our home. We have a lot of reds and blues and pinks and in the middle of it, Pine Valley Mountain. So it's impossible for me to not feel a link, something like I think Frost must have been getting at with his poem, that we're, whatever our identity is, it's inseparable, I think, with almost the geology and terrain that we have enjoyed in this land. In fact, may I read a quote?
Absolutely.
Just because it's something that I've used. This is Parley P. Pratt. Lest we seem too proud in Washington County, this is Parley P. Pratt's view from somewhere between the Black Ridge and Tocqueville. So they were coming down the ridge, and this is what he said he saw. The country southward opened to our view, as it were, a wide expanse of chaotic matter, huge hills, sandy deserts, cheerless, grassless, waterless plains, perpendicular rocks, loose, barren clay, dissolving beds of sandstone and various other elements, lying in inconceivable confusion. In short, a country in ruins, dissolved by the pelting of the storm of ages, and it was turned inside out, upside down, by terrible convulsions of a former age. Well, welcome to St. George, you know. But the ruggedness of the country, as rugged as it was, is still part of the beauty.
And I think the ruggedness of the people matched.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I agree. Can I tell a joke? Will I be run out if I say that?
I think this group will go for it.
Just make sure that my security guy is somewhere near the front here, because we used to have a sign. We used to say that there was a sign that right at the Iron County line that said, "This way to St. George," and those that could read went on, and those who couldn't stayed. Hold your applause.
Tell the same joke from Sampy to Emory County, so sorry, Mike Maurer.
As long as it's shared somewhere else.
I think the people in rural Utah are unique because they have had to be tough and rugged, and those values of hard work. Let's shift a little bit to leadership. Obviously, you've been a leader for probably your entire life. What from your experiences here in rural Utah and in southern Utah prepared you for leadership?
Well, I think you've hinted at that in your earlier comments. That it was almost the ruggedness of the country. If it wasn't literal, if we didn't actually go out and, you know, grub weeds and sagebrush, nevertheless, there was something symbolic, I think, about the ruggedness of the land, and that would apply to so many of the counties that we're talking about, really all over the state, The message was, here are the raw ingredients, you know, here's matter unorganized, and you're supposed to do something with it. And I think that was, again, maybe it was more symbolic than literal, but it was to make something out of nothing. And that meant hard work, that meant no free passes, whatever you got, you earned. And whether that was how you studied and going to school, or the honest day's work you gave for an honest day's pay at the local store where you were working, whatever, those seem to me to be leadership qualities that mattered later on. Certainly, I have to say that we did enjoy in those pioneer days and do still. A religious climate in this state that I think is precious and special. You'd expect me to say that, but it's true. So we grew up with those values, and that meant, I think, how you treated people, honesty, integrity, the Christian virtues, the moral virtues that we did enjoy and do enjoy in this state. I shouldn't say past tense, it's present tense, and these people out here represent all of that. So at its heart, leadership is how you treat people. That is the essence of any leadership position, whether it's political or economic or civic or educational or religious, whatever. It comes down to the courtesy and kindness and thoughtfulness that you use in working with the people assigned to you, or whatever your whatever group you're leading. And that was just in the air. That was we grew up with that. We watched it in wards and stakes and bishoprics and deacons' quorums and young women's classes, and that gets to be a little religious, but that's our experience. So that's what made us in great measure what we are.
So many people look up to you, and so many people to the both of you and your families, and I've learned a lot over the years about mentorship and how important that is. If you were to give us some advice here today, what did you wish you had known before you started your career?
Again, great question. I guess almost more than what I wish I had known. This is a kind of a mentoring response. I guess what I wish I had more than known would have been what I would have been able to do. I wish people might have trusted me, even as a young person, even as a teenager, say, or on into early college years, that my leaders, my bosses, whether that was the people I worked for or a leader in the church or an educational institution, that they might have let me do more. I think the hands-on experience, we underestimate a young person's ability, and we overestimate their experience. And so what we need to do as leaders is let them benefit from our experience, but let them exercise their ability and their instincts. And I think if anything, if I had it all to do over again, I'd have been more conscious of that as a leader in my own life. I'd have let people make a few more mistakes. Because people certainly were willing to let me make mistakes, and I'd give the young person coming up, young men, young women on their own trail coming up to leadership, I think I'd have tried to allow them to do more. I wish I had done that, and I kind of wish people had let me do that. It's just a kind of a leadership tip.
I love that. That's amazing. Amazing for those of us who work and mentor young people. I think that's great and wonderful advice. I've been talking in my work a lot about empathy and vulnerability. Let's talk a little bit about those traits and how you think they play a role in leadership.
Pat ought to comment on that because she is so empathetic and so good that way. Her heart is and I'll let her comment as she wants to in a moment. But I just make the bridge to what I just said, that we don't do well until we see it from his or her point of view. If it's the young person you're mentoring, that's try to see it the way they see it. If it's a peer who is a little argumentative and a little hard to get along, try to see it the way he or she sees it. I think, the only way we really make headway is get out of our own boots, get out of our own seat, try to move across the room and be in their shoes. And that isn't necessarily compromise. I think it's understanding. I don't think anybody has to compromise a principle, but we might be more patient. We might be more long-suffering. We might call on those Christian virtues we just talked about to allow us to see it from another person's point of view, be empathetic, be a little vulnerable. What that means is, I think part of vulnerability is to not insist on your own way, not stay in your safe zone where you're quite secure and sure you've got this all figured out. Be a little vulnerable and toss it to the other person and listen and learn. And there's a humility in that, but a contemporary word for it, I think, would be vulnerability. Any thoughts on that, huh?
I'll speak about my husband. I think he learned his vulnerability, learned how to be vulnerable and also empathetic from his mother. She was just a wonderful teacher, and she allowed him to do a lot more than he remembers. But he learned so much from her. She empathized with everybody in St. George, and she knew everyone at that point. And she passed it on to Jeff, who loves everybody unconditionally. And I don't think he could do that without empathy and allowing himself to be vulnerable. He related to every age, children to adults. It's remarkable.
That's incredible. And I think, you know, I've talked many times about the empathy crisis we're seeing in our country. We're not looking out. We're not trying to get to know somebody that has a different story than we do. So I love right. that about moving across the room and finding a way to connect with somebody that's different from you. So this probably wasn't a question you were prepared for, but as we close here, I would love for each of you to talk about many of us, you know, are struggling with coming out of the pandemic. How do we navigate through this? Most of us had unexpected children back home, ones that had left, and we had some challenges. We've had work challenges. I guess the question is, how do you think? What's your advice for families today navigating this incredibly difficult time in our world history, basically?
Do you want to start?
I would like to say don't approach the coming in and out of COVID in fear. There is so much that we learn in situations like that. And if we focus on the positive part, there were a lot of positives to the COVID experience. And there, I think we learned empathy for those who were sick. And it was just, that's the way I feel.
Yeah, I love that because I heard a quote that said, if you leave the pandemic as you came in, you're doing it wrong. So if we haven't learned, then we've probably done it wrong.
I think, again, I can't get away from the fact that I'm an officer in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we have a worldwide organization and operation, and it was a pretty challenging issue for us to have 60,000, 70,000 missionaries out, and some of them had to come home, and some of them didn't. We have missionaries out now who've been out 3 years and still cannot get home. They cannot return to their country because of local barriers. That's kind of a challenging experience that some missionaries, some 19-year-old didn't think about, or 18-year-old when they went, and their parents didn't think about when they sent them. So we've had to juggle a lot. We had to learn how to have state conferences by Zoom, and to tour missions and handle humanitarian service and welfare relief without being face to face. All the issues that you know we had to work with institutionally, but we've learned a lot. I think that's part of what Pat is saying is, and what you're suggesting, that if we haven't learned something, we've been pretty dull. We've been pretty insensitive. Because every cloud has a silver lining, and this has had some. We wouldn't have chosen, none of us would have chosen to have the tragedy of the deaths and the other things that we've experienced. But it is what it is, and so we learn what we can learn, and we're going to do some things differently in the future, speaking for the church, and some of those institutional things apply here, whether it's corporate or educational or governmental. We're going to do some of our meetings. We're going to continue to hold by Zoom. And, of course, there's no substitute for face-to-face experience either, and we'll do that. But we're going to come out with a hybrid of some things, and we'll be better. I talk about these missionaries that were frustrated. For a while, they didn't know what to do, kind of locked in their apartments, and then they learned how to use technology. They learned how to use Facebook and Instagram and have their member neighbors assist them. And so we'll probably do missionary work differently than we have ever done it because of what we were forced to learn. So we'll be blessed, and this audience will be blessed. They'll find their businesses and their operations, their schools, all the things that they represent. We'll be doing some things better in all of those worlds because of this. Not that we'd have chosen it, but we can benefit from it.
Absolutely. I think that's perfect. I had two missionaries that were impacted. I had one that came home and was home for 4 months before being reassigned, and I have currently one in Little Rock, Arkansas, yeah, who's trying to get to Brazil.
We've had the same experience. We had a South Korean who came home and is currently in Independence, Missouri, and a granddaughter waiting to go to Brisbane, Australia, and she's in Bakersfield, California. So welcome to the church. Welcome.
And welcome to the pandemic.
Welcome to the pandemic.
We are going to adjust, and we're going to keep adjusting, and we're going to keep pivoting, and we're going to keep trying to be empathetic to somebody's story. Yeah. So thank you for your leadership in the state. Thank you for your example. And thank you for being part of our summit here today.
We're honored in every way, every conceivable way.
And thank you for all you do for the state. We are so blessed to have such a remarkable couple leading our state.
We are indeed. The audience knows where the governor is. We had a good visit. I had a visit with the governor yesterday. So courteous. So he was a busy man. He took the time to be on Zoom. Take advantage of modern technology to say that he wouldn't be here today. We had a good visit, but we are, in that spirit, very, very proud of both of you and grateful for your leadership.
Thank you so much. Thank you.